On November 9th through the 11th, the Federal Society hosted the 2023 National Lawyers Convention in Washington, D.C. This year's theme was Originalism on the Ground, and it featured many excellent speeches, debates, and discussion panels covering a wide range of important legal and policy issues. This recording comes from that event, and we hope you enjoy it.
Welcome back. My name is Dean Reuter, still. Still Senior Vice President and General Counsel of the Federalist Society. Can't hear me? Can you hear me now? Okay. Can you hear me now? The people up front can't hear me, so I hope it's not too loud for the people in the back. Welcome to the final event of this year's National Lawyers Convention. Before we begin, I do want to take a moment to have a moment of silence in observation of Veterans Day. Thank you very much. One business announcement: if you're getting CLE, remember to use the QR code to sign out of CLE. If you fail to do that, you'll probably be claiming 250 hours of CLE sometime next week. I wanted to repeat some information I provided this morning since I see so many new faces in the audience, and that is people were asking about the annual dinner and who was in attendance, who wasn't in attendance. I'm at liberty to tell you there were four justices in attendance at the annual dinner, so no decisions were made, but look for a cert grant in the orders list. And now I want to say just a brief word, if I could, about the Federalist Society itself and my gratitude for working at the Federalist Society. It's one of the best jobs ever in one of the greatest organizations in town and in the country, and that is because of the people in this room. It is because of the Federalist Society members, which I think everyone recognizes as the true strength of the organization. Even when we were a smaller organization, it was about numbers and it was about networks, and it's about our business model, where there are very few of us in the home office, but it's all the members who get everything done. So thank you for being a member of the Federalist Society. I want to describe one problem the Federalist Society has never had, even when it's small, by way of demonstrating this. This is a little story. This story describes a different kind of convention than the Federalist Society, and a single speaker at this hypothetical convention was speaking, and there was only one person in the audience. Now, as he was reaching the end of his remarks, this speaker said, "If you don't mind, I'm going to skip the Q&A and head straight to the airport so I can catch my flight." And the lone person in the office said, "Actually, I do mind. I'm the next speaker." So thankfully, we've never, ever had that sort of problem here at the Federalist Society. And now we are. I will let you know that we're very pleased, so pleased, to host the annual Robert H. Bork Memorial Lecture. Judge Bork, of course, is remembered for his outsized impact in many areas of law, discussed throughout the panels held over the last couple of days and talked about through the year, actually, at the Federalist Society. His impact in the fields of administrative law and regulation, antitrust, and many more will never fade. And his commitment to originalism, the themes of this year's convention, will never be forgotten. A friend of the Federalist Society, Judge Bork's memory and legacy endure within this organization, and we're so pleased to carry on the tradition of taking some meaningful time to recognize his contributions to us and to the country through this important lecture. Before we head into the next installment of this important lecture series, I'll briefly direct your attention to the pamphlet that should have been on everyone's seat. These pamphlets, made possible by the generous support of Mary Ellen Bork, are the published version of the remarks delivered at last year's Bork Lecture by the Honorable A. Raymond Randolph, who provided what I thought was an excellent biographical look at Judge Bork and his legacy, which is well worth reading. Now I'll take a moment to welcome members of the Bork family. We're very pleased to have his wife, Mary Ellen Bork, here, and her brother. We welcome also his son, Bob Bork, and grandson, Robert Bork III. Thank you for being here. And of course, we are honored to host as our speaker for today's lecture, the Honorable Thomas B. Griffith, for his address entitled Toxic Political Polarization and the Judiciary. Judge Griffith served on the United States Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit Court from his appointment in 2005 until he stepped down in 2020. And as a former judge, he's uniquely qualified to discuss this important and timely issue. If you're not already familiar with our esteemed final speaker, I'll give you a brief introduction before yielding the stage. Former Judge Griffith currently serves as a lecturer on law at Harvard Law School, a fellow at the Wheatley Institute at Brigham Young University, and special counsel in the Washington, D.C. office of the law firm Hunton Andrews Kurth. Most recently, he was a member of President Biden's Commission on the Supreme Court, and he is the author of Civic Charity and the Constitution. Before being appointed to the D.C. Circuit, Judge Griffith was the general counsel at BYU, Senate legal counsel, and a partner at Wiley, Ryan, and Fielding, all at different times, I assume. Long active in rule of law programs in former communist nations, he's a member of the International Advisory Board of the CEELI Institute in Prague. He's a graduate of BYU University and the University of Virginia School of Law, and is a member of the American Law Institute. Judge Griffith, thanks so much for joining us today. The stage is yours.
Thank you very much, Dean. Mrs. Bork, Bob Bork, Robert Bork III, members of the Bork family. I see some of my former colleagues here, Judge Bea and Judge Hardiman. There may be others that I can't see. It's an honor to be here. I'm honored to be able to speak, especially in a lecture series that honors the memory of Judge Robert Bork. You know, we're all indebted to Ed Whalen for his Confirmation Tales column. Forgive me in my self-indulgence in telling you my story. And I tell it not because it features me, although, truth be told, that's part of the reason I'm telling it, but I tell it to you because it features Judge Bork prominently. Although it was a far from pleasant experience, my Senate confirmation experience was smooth sailing compared to the tempestuous proceedings others have endured, and for that I am grateful. In fact, I was surprised that I was not asked some hard questions, which in hindsight seem indispensable to the Senate properly performing its constitutional duty to give the president advice and consent on his judicial nominations. For example, I should have been asked my views on how a judge ought to interpret the Constitution. Are you an originalist, a legal realist, a believer in the living Constitution? I should have been asked how a judge ought to read statutes. Do you favor Eskridge's dynamic interpretation, or are you a textualist? Or I should have been asked my view on the role of regulations. Is Chevron deference an abdication of the judicial role, or a properly deferential response to a delegation of legislative power from the Congress to the executive branch? I was asked none of those things. In fact, I don't remember being asked any question along any of those lines, except one. That question came early in the process, even before the president had nominated me. I was invited to the White House to interview with Judge Alberto Gonzalez, then counsel to President Bush, and several of his colleagues in the West Wing. The interview went very well, and I was told afterwards that it would be helpful to my chances if I could show that I would have the support of the Republican and Democratic Senate leaders I had worked for as Senate legal counsel, the nonpartisan chief legal officer of the Senate. I went immediately to see the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, who was then Senator Orrin Hatch, who I was happy but not surprised to learn was willing to be an enthusiastic supporter. Next was a visit with Senator Harry Reid, then the whip of the Democratic Conference, who was likewise encouraging. Senator Reid insisted that I meet with Democratic leader Tom Daschle. I had come to know Senator Daschle well during my time as a staffer, and we both respected and liked one another. Now, as is often the case when meeting with a busy senator, especially when not part of his planned schedule, I had to wait for a while in the reception of his office. Upon learning that I was waiting to see Senator Daschle, his chief of staff kindly invited me into his own office for a pleasant reunion in which we recalled projects we had worked on together. Senator Daschle then briefly joined us, greeted me with a warm hug, and voiced pleasure that I was under consideration for an appointment to the DC Circuit. It was all very, very heady stuff. But there was another person in the room who I did not know personally. He had not been on Senator Daschle's staff while I served the Senate. I did know, however, that he was the architect of the Democrat strategy to filibuster some of President Bush's judicial nominees, including the nominee whose withdrawal from consideration created an opening for me. The gray hairs among us will recall that was Miguel Estrada. Yep, I'm what you get when you really want Miguel Estrada on the DC Circuit, but Senate Democrats wield the filibuster. In short, I'm an argument for or against the filibuster. Feel free to tell me your views later in private on that. So when Senator Daschle left the room, the staffer started asking me questions to probe, who was this guy? Predictably, he asked me which judge had most shaped my thinking about the law. John Marshall, I said, assuming that was a safe answer. But that was not the tough question. He added, other than John Marshall. I paused for a moment because that was the tough question, because the answer was Robert Bork. And I hesitated to confess this to the architect of the Democrats' filibuster strategy. Judge Bork was anathema to many progressives. The smoke from his confirmation battle lingered still in the Senate hallways. So with more than a little anxiety and imagining that I was about to write my own chapter in Profiles in Courage, I mustered strength and answered truthfully, Judge Bork, I agree with his views about the role of a judge. Well, there was a slight pause in the confirmation and in the conversation that made me uneasy. I was certain that I had just thrown away my nomination hopes. But I was wrong. Sensing my anxiety, the staffer assured me that my answer was acceptable. Don't worry, Tom, he said. We understand that President Bush gets to appoint judicial conservatives to the bench. Well, emboldened by that response, I declared myself an acolyte of Robert Bork throughout the confirmation process. It must have worked. I was confirmed by a wide margin. Now, I became aware of Robert Bork during my first year of law school at UVA. I actually remember the moment when I pulled volume 47 of the Indiana Law Journal from a shelf in the library and began reading Neutral Principles and some First Amendment Problems. I don't want to make too much of the moment. No heavenly choir or rushing wind accompanied my reading. But I don't want to make too little of it either. I found Judge Bork's approach to the Constitution and to the role of judges in our democratic republic immensely satisfying. In those pages, I found, for the first time I can remember, an articulate rebuke to much of what I had been learning in law school about how judges should do their work under the Constitution. Bear with me. The old folks are going to be very familiar with what I'm about to do. I'm going to give you a summary of Judge Bork's views, cobbled together from his writings with some editorial license. I do this for the benefit of the youngsters in the audience. This used to be canonical, creedal, amongst conservatives. Less so now. Here we go. The United States was founded as a Madisonian system, which means that it contains two opposing principles that must be continually reconciled. The first principle is self-government, which means that in wide areas of life, majorities are entitled to rule, if they wish, simply because they are majorities. The second is that there are nonetheless some things majorities must not do, some areas of life in which the individual must be free of majority rule. In these latter areas, majorities cannot rule, no matter how democratically they decide to do so. These are the areas properly left to individual freedom, and coercion by the majority in these aspects of life is tyranny. The structure of the Constitution places the all-important function of defining these otherwise irreconcilable principles of majority power and minority freedom in a non-political institution, the federal judiciary. Placing this function with the courts creates the seeming anomaly of judicial supremacy in a democratic society. If the judiciary really is supreme, able to rule when and as if it sees fit, the society is not democratic. For that reason, it is as important to freedom to confine the judiciary's power to its proper scope as it is to confine that of the president, Congress, or state and local governments. Indeed, it is probably more important, for only courts may not be called to account by the public. Okay, that's my summary. You've just tried to reduce in a couple of paragraphs the heart of Judge Bork's views about the role of a judge. Judge Bork relied heavily on the seminal article by Professor Herbert Wexler, Toward Neutral Principles of Constitutional Law, which was originally delivered as the Oliver Wendell Holmes lecture at the Harvard Law School. According to Wexler, the deepest problem of our constitutionalism, the deepest problem of our constitutionalism is laid bare when courts function as a naked power organ. This occurs, according to Wexler, when a judge who is supposed to apply the law lets his judgment turn on the immediate result. That is, whether the outcome advances a cause he personally favors as a citizen. To avoid this problem, Wexler insists that judges must resolve the cases before them according to neutral principles, by standards that transcend the case at hand. Rather than impose their own value determinations, in every case, judges must derive, define, and apply generally applicable neutral principles gleaned from authoritative legal texts. Okay, that's the end of the recitation of abstract, dry ideas, but they're not dry. They're the living, the essence of Judge Bork's view of the role of a judge. In short, according to Judge Bork, the structure of the Constitution, which places the lawmaking function with we the people through elected representatives, demands that judges be neutral. Now, the day after my confirmation, the confirmation of my nomination to the D.C. Circuit, I was the happy recipient of many congratulatory messages. I found out that some of my friends had sons and daughters who were in law school. I hadn't heard from them in years. It was wonderful. One of these happy congratulatory messages, not about a child in law school, but just a good friend calling, came from a former law partner of mine who had clerked on both the D.C. Circuit, to which I was about to join, and the Supreme Court. And he was a person who, over the years, I had valued his judgment. "Tom," he asked, "can I give you some advice about being a judge?" I was eager to learn. I anxiously wanted to hear what he had to say. So here's what he had to say. He said, "The first day of my clerkship on the D.C. Circuit, my judge told me, this is how we go about our work. First, we learn the facts of the case as best we can, because these are real people, and they deserve to know that they're heard. That's the first thing we do. The second thing we do is we think long and hard about the fair outcome, the equitable disposition, the just result. And once we've figured that out, we go find law to support our conclusion. Well, because the call's purpose was congratulatory and not an invitation to engage in an extended discussion of the role of the judge under the Constitution, I thanked my friend for his counsel. But as I hung up the phone, I took a vow that I would do my best to heed his advice, his first bit of advice, to learn the facts of the case as best I could, and that I would take a vow that I would never heed his advice to decide cases by my own carefully developed sense of the common good. So, but with my friend's experience in mind, I took a different approach to my clerk's first day in chambers. I handed them a binder of readings, the first entry of which was 47 Indiana Law Journal 1, something like the first chapter of Exodus. So, okay, which brings me to the present moment, Now, I was not on the campus at Yale Law School in April 1982 for the first event of the Federalist Society, but soon thereafter, I became an avid supporter, and over the years have spoken at dozens of chapter events on law school campuses across the nation, on numerous panels at the National Lawyers Convention, and I've even done some heavy lifting behind the scenes to protect the Federalist Society. What Leonard Leo and Gene Meyer and Lee Otis and others have done to transform the American legal landscape is breathtaking. It's breathtaking. But I have some concerns. Back in the day, it was dedication to the idea of judicial conservatism that inspired us. We would work ourselves into a frenzy, jumping up and down, arms clad in a circle while chanting, "Neutral principles, neutral principles, neutral principles." Yet from some of the talks I hear at Federalist Society gathering these days, I wonder, did I step out of the room at a key moment and miss the explanation that we would talk about neutral principles so long as progressives were in control, but once we got our people on the bench, once we had judges who were political conservatives, we would abandon judicial conservatism. Now I understand the appeal of judicial engagement to pursue one's sense of the common good. I'm not sanguine at all about the state of our nation, but I'm here to urge us to resist that temptation. You will recognize the following from Professor Vermeule's influential article, Beyond Originalism, a short quote. "Originalism has now outlived its utility and has become an obstacle to the development of a robust, substantively conservative approach to constitutional law and interpretation. It is now possible to imagine a substantive moral constitutionalism that takes as its starting point moral principles that conduce to the common good, principles that judges should read into the majestic generalities and ambiguities of the written Constitution. The sweeping generalities and famous ambiguities of our Constitution, says Professor Vermeule, afford ample space for substantive moral readings that promote peace, justice, abundance, health, and safety." End of quote. My friend, Chief Judge William Pryor, has ably pointed out the danger in this approach. I simply add my amen and amen to Judge Pryor. It seems that Professor Vermeule's model jurist is not Judge Bork or Justice Scalia, but Justice Douglas. Indeed, Professor Vermeule's sweeping generalities and famous ambiguities sounds a lot like Justice Douglas's penumbras formed by emanation. Common good originalism is what judicial conservatives been fighting all this time. The only difference between this approach and the living constitution espoused by progressives is the political result their proponents seek. Although I might cheer some of the results that emerge from such an approach, that is not the role of the judge that Judge Bork envisioned or that I believe the Constitution requires. If we're willing to sacrifice principled legal thought for the sake of what is, make no mistake, political expedience, then I think we've given up the fight for an independent judiciary. We will have encouraged the courts to function as the naked power organ Wexler and Bork warned against, and thus we will wreak havoc on our democracy. On those courts where progressives are in the majority, and they will be, the pendulum ever swings, they will quote Professor Vermeil to impose their own vision of the common good based on their own moral principles. Professor Vermeil's approach reminds me of the oft-quoted colloquy in Robert Bolt's play, A Man for All Seasons. Justice Scalia would quote this to his students at the University of Virginia in a rousing finale to the course. The gray hairs among us remember the scene. We grew up with it. Thomas More's family, spurred on by his zealous future son-in-law, Will Roper, urges the arrest of Richard Rich because he is a bad man. Now, forgive my lame attempt at acting, but I'm going to recite the colloquy here. Margaret, father, that man's bad. More, there's no law against that. Roper, there is God's law. More, then God can arrest him. Alice, while you talk, he's gone. More, and go he should, if he were the devil, until he broke the law. Roper, now you'd give devil the benefit of the law? More, yes, what would you do? Cut a road through the law to get after the devil? Roper, yes, I'd cut down every law in England to do that. More, and when the last law was down and the devil turned on you, where would you hide, Roper, the laws all being flat? This country is planted with laws from coast to coast, man's laws, not God's, and if you cut them down, and you're just the man to do it, do you really think you could stand upright in the winds that would blow then? Yes, I'd give the devil benefit of law for my own safety's sake. As an aside, I read this colloquy to my law clerks the day my opinion was released in House Judiciary Committee versus McGahn. Look it up, you'll see why I read it. Years ago, I was honored to moderate the Rosenkrantz debate at the National Lawyers Convention. The disputants were Hadley Arkus, my dear friend and soulmate in so many ways but one, and Judge Alex Kaczynski. The question, as I recall, was whether judges should use the natural law. Hadley went first, and typically, he was eloquent and hilarious. Judge Kaczynski followed. As I recall, his reply was brief. It went something like this. Hadley, I don't disagree with a single thing that you said about the natural law. I have only one response to your argument that judges should use the natural law. Stephen Reinhardt. You want to invite Stephen Reinhardt to use the natural law in his decisions? I'm sorry, my dear friend Hadley, but in my view, Judge Kaczynski won the debate that day. Now, I know what you're going to say. I'm going to avoid it. He's going to say, you haven't read my book yet. Okay. You haven't sent it to me yet. But anyway. The issue isn't whether there's natural law. I'm a Christian. Of course there is. The issue, as Judge Sutton constantly reminds us, is who decides. And the project of judicial conservatism, as I have understood it and tried to practice it, has been to keep the scope of the judiciary's power within the confines the Constitution requires so as to preserve democratic values. But this is not the only threat to Judge Bork's view of the role of a judge. Although my embrace of Judge Bork wasn't a stumbling block to my confirmation in 2005. The times have changed, and now we see a full-throated attack on this approach from progressives. I doubt that my public embrace of Judge Bork would have been given a pass in my confirmation proceedings had I been nominated in 2019 instead of 2004. I witnessed this current hostility time and again as one of the few conservative members of President Biden's Commission on the Supreme Court. We were the five or six who made the enterprise bipartisan. There were five or six of us out of a group of 36. Now, some criticized that imbalance. I think it was Josh Blackman who noted that conservatives were overrepresented on that commission in comparison to the typical faculty lounge. So, while on the commission, repeatedly, I would hear some of my fellow commissioners decry the Roberts Court as illegitimate. For many, it was a mantra that preceded almost every comment. They seemed to subscribe to the view of Michael Klarman in his foreword to the Harvard Law Review issue covering the October 2019 term of the Supreme Court. He titled his article, without any nuance at all, quote, "The Degradation of American Democracy and the Court." If you haven't read Professor Klarman's article, here's my summary, which was first offered in my response to his foreword, also published in the Harvard Law Review. Professor Klarman's thesis, and what I would hear from many of my colleagues on the Supreme Court Commission, is that conservatives have declared war on democracy. The justices on the Supreme Court, he argues, defend the interests of the Republican Party, not because of any principled legal reasoning, but because of their personal values and political calculations. Klarman's solution to preserve democracy is straightforward. Democrats should win the presidency and the Senate, entrench democracy against future Republican attacks with a series of bold moves like ignore the constitutional provision mandating two senators for every state, create new states to expand their advantage in the Senate and the Electoral College, replace the Electoral College with a direct popular vote, and consider packing new seats on the Supreme Court and the lower federal courts with judges appointed by Democratic presidents. Needless to say, Klarman's form of constitutional hardball would radically reshape our political system. Professor Klarman's attack upon the independence of the judiciary is especially troubling. In his view, it is, quote, probably inevitable, close quote, that liberal and conservative judges will not act as neutral arbiters of law, but will instead, quote, legally rationalize the outcomes they prefer on controversial issues. In discounting the possibility of an impartial judiciary, in abandoning that ideal, Professor Klarman and so many progressives embrace the unlikeliest of allies. I quote from Professor Klarman's article. One of the truest things President Trump has said in office is that there are Obama judges and Trump judges. Klarman asks, can anyone honestly think differently? Well, actually, I do. Having served alongside judicial appointees of every president from Carter to Trump, I have seen firsthand the judges can and do put aside party and politics in a good faith effort to interpret the law correctly. The judges I have known and with whom I have worked closely are committed to applying the law and not imposing their political preferences. I am not troubled by the fact that some judges read the New York Times instead of the Wall Street Journal. Most of them read both. Nor is it helpful to refer to Republican justices, a phrase Professor Klarman and many of my colleagues on the Supreme Court Commission used dozens of times. The historical fact of an appointment by a Republican president didn't matter to the justices who decided Hamdan, Bostock, Obergefell, or NFIB versus Sebelius. It never mattered to Chief Judge Sutton either. It is no doubt cathartic to impugn the motives and the character of judges who have different political or philosophical commitments, but it does great damage to public confidence in the judiciary, the crown jewel of our constitutional institutions. And now let me tell you a story that came out of my time on President Biden's Commission on the Supreme Court, and it came from Walter Dellinger, the late Walter Dellinger, who was a frequent guest at Federalist Society events, even though he had very different views from many of us. There was some, I can't remember the exact nature of the colloquy, but I was giving this, this was sort of my mantra on the commission. What do you mean, illegitimate? They were nominated by a president, confirmed by the Senate, appointed by a president, they took the oath of office. That's legitimate, right? Stop saying they're not legitimate. That was sort of, that was like my standard line throughout. And at one point in the proceedings, Walter Dellinger came to my defense and told the story. You may recall that when he was the acting Solicitor General, he argued the Clinton versus Jones case, and he argued that the lawsuit against President Clinton should be postponed until after his presidency as a form of presidential immunity from litigation. He lost that 9-0. He lost that 9-0. Walter told the story before the commission of where he was and how he learned of that loss. He was somewhere in China, I can't remember if he was in Beijing or where, but he was somewhere in China speaking to a group of Chinese law students when word came down that he had lost in front of the Supreme Court of the United States, representing the President of the United States by 9-0. His students could not imagine that. Could not imagine that. So he, the losing litigant, explained to them what a great thing this was. What a great thing this was. But the idea of judicial independence is a fragile possibility in the best of times. Unfortunately, we don't live in the best of times. In the final opinion I wrote on the D.C. Circuit, I warned against the dangers of reflexively imputing political positions to judges based on the party who appointed them. The D.C. Circuit, sitting in bank, had voted to deny General Michael Flynn's petition for a writ of mandamus compelling dismissal of the criminal prosecution against him. I joined the majority, but wrote separately to emphasize that despite the media's hyperbolic coverage and the inflammatory description served up by the conflict entrepreneurs of cable, the issue before the court was actually quite narrow and apolitical. We were not asked to decide whether General Flynn's prosecution was justified, nor whether political favoritism played an impermissible role in the government's decision to stop pursuing that prosecution. Instead, we were asked to answer a simple question. Should the Court of Appeals intervene and grant the government's motion to dismiss before the district court had actually issued a decision? Following established precedent, we declined to do so. I wrote to challenge the view that I knew would surely follow by some on cable, that this decision was motivated by partisan impulses. Now, if you'll forgive me for quoting me, it's not long. In cases that attract public attention, it is common for pundits and politicians to frame their commentary in a way that reduces the judicial process to little more than a skirmish in a partisan battle. The party affiliation of the president who appoints a judge becomes an explanation for the judge's real reason for the disposition, and the legal reasoning employed is seen as a cover for the exercise of raw political power. No doubt, there will be some who will describe the court's decision today in such terms, but they would be mistaken. The questions presented are far removed from the partisan skirmishes of the day. Their resolution in this case involves nothing more and nothing less than the application of neutral principles about which reasonable jurists on this court disagree. I then cited 47 Indiana Law Journal 1 as a somewhat self-indulgent but grateful tip of the hat to the great man. What I wrote holds true for the vast majority of cases the federal courts hear. Judges may split along ideological lines, sometimes quite predictably, but partisanship is rarely, if ever, the explanation for that division. And where it might be, let's not applaud that departure from the ideal. Let's call it out as a mistake. Justice Barrett has taken issue with those who claim that the justices are partisans in robes. Her evidence that they are not? Read our opinions, she challenges the critics. Inspired by that challenge, I now tell my students that I will not listen to their criticism of Obergefell from the right or Dobbs from the left until they have sworn by affidavit that they have read all of the opinions in the case twice. I'm exaggerating, but I do tell them, I'm not going to talk to you about it unless you tell me you've read all of the opinions. Such a careful reading shows diligent judges struggling with vexing legal issues in good faith. Justice Kennedy was not intent on destroying the traditional family, nor was Justice Alito seeking to harm women. Each was trying to discover what the law required, and on that, reasonable people can disagree. These cases reveal the hard work that the justices put into understanding the views of the party and each other in an effort to reach the correct legal outcome. They demonstrate the justices' willingness to compromise and to sometimes decide cases more narrowly than they might otherwise for the sake of consensus. And they reveal that even as the justices work through difficult and contentious issues, they strive to engage in civil discourse and treat one another with respect. We all know of the relationship of mutual respect and affection between Justices Ginsburg and Scalia. But have we read Justice Thomas's note to Justice Breyer upon his retirement? Or have we read Justice Kagan's tribute to Chief Justice Roberts last year at the American Law Institute? Do you know about the deep friendship between Justices Sotomayor and Barrett, which Justice Barrett described so movingly at last spring's Rex E. Lee Award luncheon? Among the American people, the judiciary remains the most respected of the branches of the federal government. Why? Why is that? Might it be because the judiciary is the constitutional institution that engages in reasoned discourse most often? That is a model that Professor Klarman and progressives should embrace and not excoriate. Just to be clear, I am no Dr. Pangloss. We do not live in the best of all possible worlds. Indeed, as I have written, and as I include in almost all my public remarks these days, I believe that the Republic is in peril on a number of fronts. I decry those who undermine confidence in the administration of our national elections by their baseless claims of fraud and conspiracy. Judge Luttig, Judge McConnell, Ben Ginsburg, and I, along with other conservatives, wrote about this serious threat to the Constitution in our report, Lost, Not Stolen, the conservative case that Biden won and Trump lost the 2020 presidential election. In fact, I am not confident that we will meet Benjamin Franklin's oft-quoted challenge at the close of the Philadelphia Convention to keep the republic the delegates had just created. As I see it, the greatest danger to the republic is not misguided policy proposals, but the rot of contempt that infects our body politic and has become the animating spirit of much of our public discourse. On that view of things, Professor Klarman's Jeremiad is no cure for the infection that ails the heart of our democracy. Indeed, the tone and temper of his complaint compound the problem. America's experiment in representative democracy and representative government has faced serious crises before. But the best models of how to navigate treacherous shoals have done so with what scholar Matthew Holland calls civic charity, a settled intention to treat our fellow citizens as partners, even as friends in a common enterprise, not as enemies. Okay, let's start with the Philadelphia Convention of 1787 that created the Constitution. In July, the delegates faced the very real prospect of failure. Yet by mid-September, they had produced the charter that would be the basis for our enduring success as a nation. In his letter transmitting the Constitution to Congress, the indispensable man, George Washington, attributed this surprising turn of events, what one popular account of the convention called the miracle at Philadelphia. Washington attributed that to, quote, the spirit of amity and of that mutual deference and concession which the peculiarity of our political situation rendered indispensable. Derek Webb does a deep dive into the meaning of Washington's explanation in his article, The Original Meaning of Civility, Democratic Deliberation at the Philadelphia Constitutional Convention. Derek is busy working on a book version of that article. I look forward to it when it comes out. According to Derek, this spirit of amity Washington referred to was a commitment to civic friendship, even among political rivals from widely different geographical backgrounds. That commitment was expressed in the practices of the convention. For instance, the framers regularly dined together in Philadelphia's taverns, and they carefully designated their deliberative processes so that they would listen to one another. Attendance was mandatory, and while a delegate held the floor, the rules barred side conversations and even reading. The mutual deference to one another and the concession they practiced led to difficult compromises on contentious issues. But the miracle at Philadelphia was not a deus ex machina. It came about only because people made an effort to understand one another and were willing to give up some things they valued for the sake of unity. The Constitution they created calls upon us to commit ourselves to the same principle, compromise for the sake of unity that created the Union in the first place. At the very least, we need to approach our deliberations and discussions with civility, right? That's the easy part. But the Constitution requires more than that. As Arthur Brooks wryly observes, if I were to tell you that my wife and I are civil to each other, you would say, get some counseling, right? We must be willing to compromise, even and especially over critical matters, if we are to continue this experiment in representative government. As Yuval Levin notes, quote, the American Constitution is intended to create common ground. Its structure compels Americans to be a little more accommodating of one another. It gives us practical experience in living and acting together, end of quote. The Constitution calls upon us to develop a temperament that doesn't come naturally to most of us, humility. We must recognize that we might be wrong about what the common good requires, and that our fellow citizens might be right. The canonical expression of this constitutional temperament is Judge Learned Hand's speech from 1944, The Spirit of Liberty, a speech that Justice Scalia would quote frequently. Judge Hand writes, the spirit of liberty is the spirit which is not too sure that it's right, which seeks to understand the minds of other men and women. Most important of all, we need to see one another as friends, partners in a shared pursuit of the common good, rather than enemies. That we must make the choice to see each other's friends and not enemies is the teaching not only of the great religious traditions, but some of our greatest American heroes. Michael Gerson observed, the heroes of America are heroes of unity. Our political system, Gerson wrote, is designed for vigorous disagreement. it is not designed for irreconcilable contempt. This idea surfaces again and again in key passages from American scripture. Winthrop on the Arbella, Jefferson's first inaugural, King on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, Obama's red state, blue state speech. But most famously, at the moment of the greatest peril to our national unity, Abraham Lincoln implored, and we could all recite this, "We are not enemies, but friends. We must not be enemies. Though passion may have strained, it must not break our bonds of affection." This high-minded idealism has sustained the United States in the past and is, I believe, needed to pursue a more perfect union. We must rededicate ourselves to the virtue of civic charity and commit ourselves to the view that we are not enemies, but friends. Without that commitment, we could make this government of the people, by the people, for the people, perish from the earth. A healthy deliberative democracy depends to a large degree on accepting the premise that one's political opponents are not evil, but they are fellow citizens who hold their views and good faith and deserve respect, especially when we disagree about matters of fundamental importance. The enterprise of reasoned debate, which the framers of the Constitution knew was required to keep the republic they had created, becomes a fool's errand when the presumption of good faith is abandoned and the other side consists only of villains and demons. In that world, there is no reason to persuade, much less to listen. Arguments become nothing more than an instrument of political power, and the only sensible objective is to crush the other side. That is why it is so troubling that in our current political moment, contempt has replaced disagreement. NYU social psychologist Jonathan Haidt warns, quote, "There is a very good chance that we will have a catastrophic failure of American democracy because," says Haidt, "we just don't know what a democracy looks like when you drain all trust out of the system." I fear that this is where we are today. To an American nation deeply divided by toxic political polarization, former Utah Supreme Court Justice Dallin Oaks recently offered the most elegant explanation I have seen of what is required for citizens to heal this divide. On contested issues, he urged, we should seek to moderate and to unify. In that straightforward and simple directive, I believe Oaks captured the animating spirit that created the Constitution in 1787 and is necessary for its survival today. So, what does it mean to support and defend the Constitution in this environment? At the very least, it means we will support and defend the rights protected by the Constitution and the structures of government it created. And on those counts, there is no group I know of that is more dedicated to those ends than the Federalist Society. But to support and defend means much more than that. It means that we will support and defend the values that gave life to the process by which the Constitution was created. Remember those values? In Washington's words, the spirit of amity and of that mutual deference and concession which the peculiarity of our political situation renders indispensable. Shortly after I joined the DC Circuit, I was invited to attend a Heritage Foundation event that honored Judge Bork. I readily accepted. Only later did I learn that I was expected to sing for my meal. Not literally, not early, but I was asked to give a toast to Judge Bork. Now, many of you are well-versed in giving toasts. I'm not. I'm a Latter-day Saint. I don't drink. Who asks a Latter-day Saint to give a toast? Ed Meese does. So it was a risky decision on General Meese's part, and I was nervous, not only because I was unfamiliar with the genre, but because Judge Bork would be seated at the head table. I'll close my remarks today with the words I used to conclude that toast. When I sit as a member of the D.C. Circuit, I pull my robe from a locker across a narrow aisle from a locker that bears a brass nameplate that says Bork. Then I walk into a courtroom in which a Rembrandt-like portrait of Judge Bork hangs. He is watching, a brooding omnipresence. I am still an acolyte. May God bless the memory of Robert Bork, and may God bless you, and may God bless the United States of America. Thank you very much.